I caved in the other night and I watched the America's Next Top Model documentary.
You caved? Were you like resisting it?
Yeah, I was kind of resisting because I was like, I don't want to hear from Tyra Banks. Like, I kind of came, I came to it thinking that it was a Tyra Banks puff piece because she's like in it. And I was proven wrong, but I was avoiding it because also, like, I don't know, I've watched videos about this. L-literacy, friend of the pod, fellow YouTuber. Whoa, those words together are so hard to come out of my mouth at the same time. she has a really great comprehensive video about America's Next Top Model, and they actually feature her in the documentary, which I was like,
yeah,
good for her. Yeah, so I was like, I've seen it all, but I was working. I feel like when I'm editing, the one nice thing about it is that it's such monotonous labor, like so tedious that sometimes I can just throw something on in the background while I'm doing it. And so I've been in an editing hole and I was like, I need something to just kind of like take the edge off my brain while I do this. And so I watched it and I thoroughly enjoyed watching it.
I mean, look, I kind of the same. I wasn't necessarily resisting it, but I was like, well, what are they going to say that's new? Like, I watched all of those early seasons of America's Next Top Model and I'm the worst for it. But also, like, I watched all of the like TikTok videos of people being like, can you believe that they made them do this? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, babe, the 2000s were fucked up.
Yeah, it is always funny when young people come into old media and be like, what? Like, it's hilarious to me.
Yeah.
It feels quite ahistorical. But yeah, I mean, I have my critiques. And so we're going to launch into these because Hannah and I, we've debriefed a little bit about it. But it does not absolve Tyra of her complicity in it. I actually really enjoyed the framing device where they basically interview the producers, right? So they'll interview Tyra and then they interview Ken Monk and then they interview J. Emmanuel, Miss J, and Nigel Barker, all of whom were like, I'm pretty sure producers on the show, or was it just J. Emmanuel that was a producer?
I don't think that Nigel Barker or Miss J were producers. I didn't even know that J. Emmanuel was per se, like, he was like the creative director or whatever. Oh,
I think okay. He was a producer on the first season, but and then he was taken off of that. I'm not entirely sure.
Oh, right. Yes.
But they interview production and then they juxtapose that with interviews from former top model contestants. And they'll do like clever editing where like Tyra will say one thing and then the model will say something completely different that just makes Tyra look like such a psycho. So I appreciated that. Like, I don't think it was Tyra kind of pulling the strings to make herself look better. There's no way she can make herself look better. Like, but what was funny is that she instead came out looking like even more of a sadist. Like, that woman has serious issues.
Well, because the documentary really let her go on her typical spiels about all the impact that she's had on the modeling industry and, like, the good she's done and, like, her job as a role model and all of these things that she kind of, I feel like she must wake up every morning and look in the mirror and, like, repeat all of this to herself, because I have heard variations of, like, these speeches on Top Model and the Tyra Show, like, in different forms, like, so many times.
And whenever she does this, she really kind of erases the black models of the 80s, of which there were quite a few, like, who were, of course, not as, like, wildly popular as Naomi Campbell or Tyra Banks were in the 90s, but, like, there were still black models working. Iman, that, yeah, maybe weren't as supermodel tier, but, like, it's a little bit like, okay, but we're not acknowledging the girlies? I don't know. Yeah, her spiel is so tired at this point.
I mean, she's like an actual narcissist.
Yeah.
Like, and she has, like, I mean, looking back now, like, watching her shows, I was like, she's always has been. And I think that the documentary did a good job at sort of, like, letting her go off on these things. But, like, because we've been given so much, like, counter evidence, it kind of highlighted the, like, self-aggrandizing that she sort of participates in every day of her life.
There's a lot that it didn't go in depth with, which we'll talk about, but I think what it did a good job of was putting forth this, like, narrative thrust that it did start out, we think, it's alleged, with the intention of trying to teach younger models to, you know, be themselves, how to have a healthier intro into the industry. But the more that the show got absorbed into the industry itself, the more it actually started perpetuating and even, like, blowing up some of the industry's, like, worst qualities, which is, like, racism, colorism, like, giving people eating disorders, everything you can think of. And seeing Tyra like weaponize her own struggle against these girls who are so fucking exploited, so poor, so vulnerable in every way you can think of. And the way that she basically like turned into a sadist, like I think the way that power, and maybe she was always one to begin with, but like the way that power so totally corrupted her to the point that in the end she was willing to just completely betray her closest friends. And I think that that was really well conveyed through the series.
I agree. I think like I have a very complicated relationship with Top Model in the sense that it definitely obviously taught me or like was an early example and reinforcement of all of these really harmful sort of like norms around body image and all that. But like at the same time was also this weird meta-ness of it because it was like supposedly critical of the industry. Like it was one of the earlier examples of media criticism that I engaged with, I guess, where it was like, while somehow in the same breath telling girls they were too fat was also like, you know what, our culture has a real problem with telling girls that they're too fat.
Yeah, it contradicts itself within like a single scene.
Yeah, I think it kind of is a really perfect example of the very confusing environment that those of us who grew up in that era were like learning to be people in. And I do believe that there were like good intentions. I do believe that like Tyra Banks believes that she's done a lot of good because I think she's like crazy.
She's like fully nuts, yeah.
Fully nuts. I think that the documentary was a little, again, I watched so much of Top Model, like love Miss J. Alexander. All of these people were like figures that were like in my living room for a lot of my childhood, have a fondness for them. And I can see where they got like screwed over by the show, by Tyra, by whatever. But I also think that like while the show doesn't really give her this platform to defend herself, I think it maybe gives a little bit too much to the men involved to kind of stick up for themselves.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes the way that J. Manuel is talking, it's as if he's not an adult with like autonomy who can make his own decisions and is actively choosing to stay in this specific job. Like, I understand there's a threat of the blacklisting, but I don't know.
The thing that kept coming into my mind was, damn, it's like they read Hannah Arendt or something. Like, it felt like banality of evil a lot of the time, where so often these people were like, I was just doing my job. And it's like, oh, you're just doing your job, which is to like absolutely fuck over extremely vulnerable young women.
Yeah, and take glee from it on the show. Like, Miss J. Alexander, like, they could be mean.
Miss J. also, like, because he had a stroke, he isn't able to speak a lot during the documentary. Like, he's lost a lot of his capacity for speech, which is devastating.
Horrible,
and his ability to walk. But because of that, you don't really get his perspective on his involvement in the show either. And so they just cut to him kind of for comedic effect, like rolling his eyes or like going, ugh. And it's like, I wonder what he thinks of his participation in that. Nigel also kind of absolves himself a lot. I appreciate that Nigel's not trying to lie though. Nigel's just like, I wasn't even thinking about this at the time. And I did appreciate that. Jay, I have sympathy for J. Manuel because like there were a lot of contractual things that like forced him to be there. Like, I know, yeah, I understand that the blacklisting is like, okay.
No, I understand that, like, he was doing his job and that was the position he was put in. And then I understand, like, also, yeah, it's the times, like, people aren't necessarily going to be pointing out what was unethical about certain things the way they would now. Like, I guess the standards were different, but I still kind of feel like there is a lot of, I think there's a lot of like revisionism or like revisionist history, perhaps, maybe, in the way he's talking about it. Cause I don't know, like it, cause it ended up kind of boiling down to like him being like, Tyra bullied me. It's like, okay. And you bullied like countless vulnerable young women who were like single moms and like ex drug addicts and like,
and they don't go
high school educated
or not at all. They don't really go into, like, because they only focus on the storylines of the women that were able to come on the show and talk, which is fine. So they talk to, like, Shandy, who is the girl who had a blackout sex experience on camera that they filmed and completely exploited, and her boyfriend finds out. It's, like, a viral clip at this point of her boyfriend finding out because everyone was joking about how he's, like, you had sex, which is horrible because obviously one of the more painful moments in both of those people's lives. And I thought that was really well done when they revisited that.
Having Danielle on.
Danielle, who was like a former winner, and the way she was treated and completely shut out by the fashion industry explicitly because she had been on Top Model, which I had always wondered about, like, oh, is there a stigma because the show's seen as like tacky and cheap that these girls are not getting the work that they deserve to get, I guess, or that they were promised.
Well, I think it's one of those difficult things now, probably also because now that the fashion industry is so celebrity dominated and has, you know, to some extent gotten off its like high horse about that and is like very much like engaged with popular culture and like celebrity models. And I mean, since Kendall Jenner became a supermodel, I think that these women probably would have stood more of a chance had it, you know, all of this taken place today.
Well, and Tyra's like, and they do that off the backs of all these other girls. I'm like, shut the fuck up. No one wants to hear your opinion about this.
Literally.
And she like references like Winnie Harlow and stuff. I'm like, just stop. None of these people like you. Everyone hates you. It's, don't take credit for people's careers. Because there was that whole controversy when Winnie Harlow got big that Winnie Harlow was like, I'm not crediting America's Next Top Model with any of this. And she, everyone was like, how dare you? You're so ungrateful. Yeah. And it's like, no, that show probably hindered her career and she found success elsewhere. But no, because it's focusing on those storylines, it doesn't focus on like a lot of some other really fucked up stuff that happened and like doesn't really enter the class element of it all. Like a lot of these girls were unspeakably poor. And again, drug addicts. I think two of the former contestants have died and one of them passed away from cancer jail. But on the show, like they don't touch on how I think the most fucked up moment of the entire show was them filming jail on phone, finding out that her best friend had died. And it was like hideous that they did that. And they don't talk about it at all because I guess she's not around to be on camera to speak about this. But it's like, I don't know. Maybe you should touch on it. I don't know. It was, I felt like they could have gone more in depth with it.
When Anjali won America's Next Top Model All Stars, and then they found out that she had been like the victim of human trafficking, but they were like, you were an escort. So they literally, they knew this going in. They like crowned her. And then they like a few weeks later called her up and were like, actually, you can't be America's Next Top Model. And then took her title away. So much crazy shit.
Totally nuts. They do talk about the Tyra, we were all rooting for you, screaming fit at Tiffany. And it's kind of crazy because all of them were like, oh, we were like really horrified. Like all the other judges talk about how they were. You can even see, I don't remember this, but Janice Dickinson being like, whoa, like. Her face kind of, ghoul, she's like a gutter rat, she's like from the sewage, but even she is shocked. And then Jay is like, yeah, I actually am not even going to say on camera some the stuff that she said, but it was like really bad. Like apparently production had to talk to her afterwards. And yeah, I appreciated that they're not like, oh no, she just saw herself in this girl. It was like, no, she's like a sadist and this is like her true personality.
Well, I rewatched a season of Top Model in the pandemic with my dad. And just watching like this shit, like one, obviously it's like so fake, but also like it is just like a humiliation, or like it's like a freak show. It's just like a series of like artificial like humiliation experiments or something.
Totally. Well, they just turn it into like Fear Factor and other, like they turn it into like a game show in the most like basic sense, and it turned into slop, basically.
Even filming the model house, like doing the whole real world thing, you know, it was so exploitative. They used to always film, like two girls would always make out in the hot tub and they'd always film that, and it would like feel like a Girls Gone Wild thing.
They got so crazy last night. Yeah. Crazy show. It was interesting. I appreciated the documentary for like examining its legacy and like why it was so big, why it failed. I liked the way it was composed, like with the production versus the models. But yeah, could have gone deeper. Yeah, it could have been a little harder on the Jays and Nigel. Tyra Banks has a humiliation kink in that she likes to humiliate others. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about whether or not that is allowed at Pride. I'm Aya.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the social media phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is part two of a loose, no pun intended, history of sex on the internet, the symbiosis of our two most basic instincts, innovation and getting off. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out a lot. So if you had the misfortune of being on Twitter in 2021, it's likely you came across some pretty heated discourse surrounding Pride. A lot of Pride parades had been canceled the year before due to the pandemic, and so this was the first time we were picking up again with in-person festivities. And this is around when a historic debate about whether kink should have a presence at Pride really blew up. Hannah girl, I know you were on Twitter at this time. Did you see yes. any of this?
I did see, like, yeah, I saw bits of it. Have I, like, taken a lot of the various hot topics of the day on Twitter and put them back into, like, the recesses of my mind? Yes, but I was certainly cognizant of this debate. Yes.
How did it make you feel in your inside?
Tell you my emotion or give you my take?
Give me your somatic, like, we're gonna do a gestalt session. Where did you feel it in your body?
You know your eyes?
Yeah, I know your eyes.
They roll.
You got floaters?
Yes, it gave me, it induced my eye floaters.
Her floaters were going crazy, bro. Okay, so I went back through the annals of Twitter to dig up some raw materials, if you will. Hannah, I'm going to get you to read these tweets.
Oh my God, so many tweets you're making me read. Okay.
Yeah.
Sam, this tweet has 68,000 likes. Please don't bring kink/fetishes to Pride. There are minors attending. That hard to understand. Okay. Dead account under the same thread as this one. If I have to see someone on a leash at Pride, then I'm leaving. Kinks are not public because the people outside your home did not consent. It should not take a minor to tell people that. Nicole, this tweet has 31,000 likes. A few reminders for Pride Month. 1. Large corporations just want your money. 2. Lesbian exclusion is ugly. 3. Trans women of color are the ones that led the fight for our rights. 4. Please don't bring your kinks/fetishes to Pride. There are minors at Pride, and this can sexualize the events. Ian, all caps, exclamation point. Anyways, wanting to shield minors and children from hardcore kinks at Pride is not automatically deeming sexual experiences / queer sexuality dirty. It's just fucking shielding children from exposure to highly sexualized experiences because they're literal children. I'm not a fucking Puritan. I just don't think my 9-year-old nephew should see unsolicited adult ass Pride if he's coming to support his lesbian aunt, you twat. You twat?
Damn.
Lumine, under the same thread. Plus, not everyone consents to seeing that shit. I may be almost 20, but I sure as hell don't want to see a bunch of cis gay men violating public decency laws in my face.
Woof.
Pope Slenderman says, amazing how the Puritans are the people who want us dead, and we're being compared to them because someone sees nothing wrong with kids being exposed to BDSM at Pride events. MX Bree says, healthy BDSM means not showing off your kinks in public where not everyone can consent. There are also minor survivors and everyone on the ace spectrum. Adult after parties exist for a reason. That cat boy, under the same thread. Yes, and most prides, it's not people walking their partner on leashes in public. I'm talking about after hours events, not the main events, because some people argue there's no place for kink/BDSM at Pride. I want, all caps, boundaries, and consent is mandatory. Clara, under the same thread, says, you don't need to get naked in front of people who don't consent to appreciate the BDS.
They just have the BDSM community.
and you know what?
You don't need to get naked to appreciate BDS.
No, you don't. So true, Queen. Nada, says, people at LGBT pride events, we just want to be treated like normal people. Also people at LGBT pride events.
And so they posted a photo of a gay man wearing just like a really colorful pink costume that had like a bunch of spikes coming out of it. Like it's just a gay man in like a costume. It's okay. Not revealing either. It's just like a gay man being silly and weird. So yeah.
Yeah, the last one is, what is it with gay men wanting so desperately to be naked around children at Pride? What's not clicking? You are all very weird.
Thank you, Hannah. And also, you can't be mad at me for making you read all that, because remember when you made me read all of those chain emails when I lost my voice?
That's so true.
So, a lot of these kinds of tweets were being posted, as you can probably tell from some of them, by very young people.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think young people would be feeling this way?
Because they're less in touch with the history of Pride and of the specific role that like sex and sexuality played in like the gay rights movement, but also because, you know, like they're 20 and they're like uncomfortable with things and like don't know how to hang.
It's like a can't hang problem, maybe.
Can I say that like my experience as being an actual child at Pride, and like one of my best friends growing up, like her mom was gay and they took me a few times to Pride, and I remember the first time I was going, they were like, you know, Hannah, like, just so you know, there's going to be, you know, naked guys around and like people dressed in leather or whatever. And they just like prepared me for it. And then I went and I was like, oh, yes, there's a naked guy. Haha. Like, you know, you're like 12, whatever. You're giggling.
Yeah.
And but you're like, this is like what some like this is what someone has told me is the kind of landscape of this like space that like I am entering into. And I don't know, maybe I was just like a really cool 11-year-old, but I remained unharmed or and like really unfazed by that experience.
I will also speak for myself and say that I also beheld Pride as a minor. And like, yes, nudity when you're a kid that you see. There was this place called a Miss Behaven that was beside this restaurant that my parents and I used to go to all the time when I was growing up. And they would always have these kind of like pinup girls in the window with like pasties on. Like they were kind of in like burlesque clothing, and it made me feel kind of like shy and embarrassed, but like that was kind of the extent of it. And also seeing the stuff at Pride, like I remember just feeling a little shy and embarrassed, but not really. Yeah, I too remain unharmed, and we are speaking for ourselves here, but that is our personal experience with it.
And also, Miss Behaven was right in front of my streetcar stop when I lived at my grandma's, and that made for an interesting commute.
Tecumseh. R.A.P. Miss Behaven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I guess like in the theme of every episode we ever do at this point, I do think taking context of 2021, I think everyone's brains had kind of been festering during lockdown. I think morality discourse was reaching a peak because, you know, people had a lot of time on their hands. Like the way that these are even phrased is just so 2020, 2021. I also think some younger queer generations were coming out of the pandemic to experience the parades for the first time too. So it was kind of just like this perfect storm for this discourse to like really get heated. Hannah, what's your initial like impression of these tweets? Like what are the main theme? Like how do they make you feel, I guess?
I think I'm like, I understand the arguments that they're trying to make here. I understand, especially if you're like young and like have a certain righteousness to you where like—
And can't hang.
I can't hang. But also, I think especially perhaps with like a subsection of Gen Z that came up at this time where like everyone was really like, think of the children, you know, you kind of like have this almost like sheltered mindset where suddenly it sounds like a lot of these people are like speaking about these hypothetical children or minors of Pride, but they're probably also including themselves as like generally younger people that also feel like they're a bit.
I do feel like it's a general aging up too of like, you know, how people seem to like feel younger and younger the older they get, like a 50-year-old feels like a 30-year-old at this point. I feel like when I was 14, I remember when I first, like I was 14 in high school and my friends were going around being like, when do you want to have sex for the first time? And I remember being like, when I'm 25. And when we talked about smoking weed, I was like, I will never smoke weed. Like it was that kind of attitude, but it was like that went away the next year, basically, like really quickly.
Yeah.
And but I feel like the more that adolescence becomes like more and more arrested and delayed, it feels now like 20-year-olds are perpetuating that kind of energy.
Also, I just feel like the early 2020s, people were really like trying to push these narratives where they're like, and listen, 20-year-olds, you are a baby. You should be walked to school. Like, you need an allowance. Like, everyone was sort of acting like you weren't a child, or you weren't an adult until your, like, frontal cortex had formed or something.
Yeah, like, you need a stroller fully and a diaper.
Yeah.
So this debate was huge around this time and made even bigger by that, like, you know, that YouTuber slash, like, streamer, Vosh?
Mm-hmm.
Who I watch sometimes. I agree with him like 60% of the time, but the other 40% I'm like, woof, strong disagree. But yeah, he went on some pretty heavy anti-kink at Pride tirades around this time, which also kind of put it on the map. People were really agreeing with him en masse. Mostly what we're getting here for like the anti side of the debate is that the presence of people in like leather wear or bondage or like engaging in the miming of S&M acts or partial nudity are harmful to underage queer kids or underage allies who are attending these events. They're also being harmful, according to these people, to asexual or aromantic people who are triggered by sexual acts. And just the idea that, like, the general populace can't consent to seeing those things in public. When you look at this debate on the surface, it's pretty hard to argue against that, right? Like you're saying, Hannah, like, obviously the interest of protecting young people is important and protecting children. But when you look closer at it, it becomes pretty apparent, if you're coming in with even, like, a modicum of context to what Pride is, that this argument coming from within the queer community itself is actually peddling some ideas that are pretty harmful to that community. So for the uninformed, Pride is an annual parade that happens all over the world, which centers on the rights of LGBTQ people, typically, also to commemorate the 1969 Stonewall riots, which took place in Greenwich Village in New York. These riots were in protest of the police raids that were happening frequently among queer spaces in the 1960s, as well as general police brutality against the community. Stonewall is remembered as one of the major catalysts for the fight against LGBTQ oppression in the West. There are accounts very frequently these days that Marsha P. Johnson, a trans Black woman, threw the first, I think it's like the first brick at Stonewall.
Yeah, the first brick.
Although this has actually kind of been debunked. It hasn't been confirmed. Yeah. And it was more likely that she threw a shot glass at a window, which has also been disputed since there are no official records of that. Nonetheless, she was an indelible figure within LGBTQ activism, and she will come up a bit later. First, off the bat, the argument that Pride shouldn't be sexualized, I don't know if you feel this way, is genuinely insane. Like, much of these early protests that were happening that Pride is commemorating were in combat of anti-sodomy laws, the raiding of places where gay sex occurred. There's this one article by a gay man I was reading which talks about how in medical offices, often he is listed as MSM, man who has sex with man. He says that, quote, "We were defined by the sex we have, our risk factors, play partners, and our fuck buds. I cannot separate my identity from the sex I love." This doesn't go for everyone under the umbrella of LGBTQ+, but it's a major part of it. And also, lest we forget, AIDS, where thousands and thousands of dying queer people were ignored by a government who saw it as a biblical punishment for having gay sex. Stonewall itself was also a cruising zone. People of all persuasions, especially extremely marginalized ones like Marsha P. Johnson, who were sex workers or trans or sometimes homeless or all of the above, would go there to find lovers. Bars in other major cities function like this as well. This is where I'd like to introduce our guest for the episode, Russell Schaefer, a queer film scholar and archival fellow at the Kinsey Institute, whose forthcoming book, Smut and Sandwiches, A History of Stag Film, will be published by Duke University Press in the spring of 2027. Russell's research hits as a very important intersection here that I think helps to contextualize a lot of what we're talking about in this episode. Hello, I'd like to introduce Russell Schaefer to the podcast. Russell, can you please tell the listeners a bit about yourself? What do you do?
What do I do? So many things, too many things. I am a scholar, a teacher, an archival junkie. I love archives. They're the sexiest places in the world. I also make films, my own experimental films. I produce films for other people. I try to dip my hands into as many pies as possible and continually try to learn in the process.
You have an inherent curiosity for life.
Absolutely. We only get to do this thing one time. I want to, like, learn as much about the experience as I can.
Can you tell the listeners a bit about the work that you're doing, particularly in the realm of stag films, pornography, like kind of the research that you're involved in?
Yeah, absolutely. I was the archival fellow at the Kinsey Institute while I was dissertating. And the Kinsey Institute, for those who may not know, is an institute that was founded by Alfred Kinsey in the mid-20th century, and is one of our largest repositories of anything related to sex, gender, and reproduction in the United States. It's a beautiful place. It's also in the middle of Indiana, at Indiana University, and so it's always in the midst of culture war discourse. In the last few years, they've faced a whole lot of financial challenges, for example. And I found my way there because I was co-curating a symposium called the Orphan Film Symposium when I was a master's student at NYU. All sorts of like ephemera films that are forgotten, fallen out of copyright, abandoned. And we watched a film from the Kinsey Institute called The Janitor, which was 10 minutes long, had more text on screen than it had images of its characters. Hardcore film. And I watched it with a whole bunch of archivists, like incredible historiographic luminaries in the room, and no one had any idea what to do with it. It was such a wonderful, awkward experience in all the right ways. I think it pushed everyone to think about how sexuality played into a conversation that sometimes seems very celibate. So I went to the Kinsey, researched as a master's student, did an independent study, fell in love with their archive. They had 57 films that they thought were produced before the 1930s, which was the time period I was interested in at that point. And then I dived into stag for the next 15 years. So usually we think about stag as a hardcore film produced early in the 20th century before the theatrical porn boom of the 1970s. And almost always, they're understood to be films that were made for men, screened to groups of men in private spaces, often through clandestine networks. I think a lot of our framework comes back to the way that a film scholar whose name is Thomas Waugh described it in a book called Hard to Imagine. And as I started digging more and more, trying to like find archival evidence of what it was like to be making stag films or distributing stag films or what the larger frame was for these films that existed in the Kinsey, what I found did not match with the films that were in that archive. And I started to realize that at a certain point in our history, stag films as a concept did not necessarily mean hardcore porn. It meant sometimes Charlie Chaplin films, sometimes runaway horse films, sometimes things produced and distributed by Pathé, which was a very major French distributor at the time. Stag nights or smokers were held at Harvard. They were also held at Elks clubs. They were also held to groups of men in private. Occasionally, women were invited to them as audience members. There's just like so much in the discourse from the early 20th century that doesn't match with the frame that we landed on by the time we had theatrical porn in the 1970s.
Whoa, was this at all impacted by the motion picture production code sending certain materials into the clandestine world, or?
I think it's a part of a larger social move post-1920s, specifically around vice reform movements that were cropping up in the 1920s. Women's reform, vice reform in the 1920s is certainly a part of that. There were also organizations like the Illinois Vigilance Association, which was run by a very interesting man named Philip Yarrow. A lot of these groups were really interested in reclaiming or protecting the sanctity of the domestic sphere, as they proclaimed. And so there was this move in the 1920s to push, I think, to clarify what all different sorts of formations of vice looked like and how they would be defined. So things that felt very amorphous before, where there might have been concern about somebody watching porn with a group of men, and I'm sure they did. Instead, that term ends up sort of being co-opted by vice reformers. And in the process of that, the definitional landscape becomes really fixed. And so the language that we have, I think, comes out of this larger social panic.
I feel like your knowledge of this kind of overlaps here in the sense of like, this concept of, I guess, protecting the domestic sphere and the ways that those attempts to kind of classify and then exclude have ripple effects on certain communities, for example. How, in your opinion, like, have panics about, if we're talking about pornography here, but like pleasure impacted the LGBTQ community in particular?
I mean, in so many ways, but I think a big part of it I feel like I found my first queer theoretical frame in Michael Warner's The Trouble with Normal. I know I've heard some great complications to that specific book since, but I really do feel like there is something to be said about the way that all sexuality in some way is linked back to shame, and specifically queer sexuality is linked back to shame. And one of the ways that our larger heterocentrist society operates is to foreclose, in Warner's words, foreclose access to pleasure and possibility. So effectively, if we don't know what's out there for us, especially when like we're young folks and we're exploring ourselves maybe for the first time, very easily fall into the modes of representation that we see out in the world, the pleasures that it appears like others are enjoying. And I think that that becomes a real problem for queer folks specifically, where either we try to emulate what we see and it isn't working and we don't know how to deal with that. And ultimately, we need to be able to find community. We need to be able to see others who are experiencing pleasures of their own and be able to see, like, that one's for me, that one's not for me. Like, I feel a certain sort of way when I learn about this or I understand this as a possibility, and I feel a different sort of way with these other options.
Summer always makes me rethink what I'm reaching for every day. Lightweight fabrics, better materials, pieces that just feel good the moment you put them on and look effortless. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. They focus on high-quality essentials. Think breathable linen, soft organic cotton, washable silk, but without the luxury markup. It's that rare balance where everything feels elevated but still easy. There's nowhere I'd rather be on a hot afternoon than at the park, lying in the grass. And there's nothing I'd rather be wearing than my 100% European linen shorts from Quince. They're comfy, lightweight, and make me feel like I'm frolicking through a field in the south of France. And, you know, I always come to the park prepared. I'm bringing a book, snacks, and a blanket. Thankfully, Quince has an impeccable selection of Italian leather totes that are perfect for transporting everything a girl could need on a summer day. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/rehash for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash. Your home is more than just furniture. It's an extension of who you are. Even small details like a rug can completely change how a space feels. That's why I love Ruggable. With so many styles to choose from, you're sure to find the right fit for you. I have one of their farmhouse style rugs in my living room, and it's completely transformed the space. The pattern is inspired by traditional quilts, and it gives the room the cozy, crafted feel I've been wanting. Plus, it's made for real life. It's stain-resistant, machine-washable, and pet-friendly, which is a game-changer as someone living with flatmates and a cat. Refresh your home at Ruggable.com. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with promo code REHASH at Ruggable.com. That's RUGGABLE.com, and use the code REHASH at checkout. Nice.
As an extension of that argument that people on the anti side of things argue that like kink sexualizes pride, that being kinky has nothing really to do with being LGBTQ. And so why do people insist on displaying their kinks at pride? Like the two are mutually exclusive in their minds. Straight people can also be kinky. Could you see an argument for why kink would actually be inextricable from the LGBTQ community? Like, what do you think the correlation between being LGBTQ and kink is?
I mean, I think just the idea that, like, I mean, obviously this has changed, like, in our lifetimes even, but there was once a time where, like, all of that fell under the same umbrella because it was all... Taboo's not the right word. I mean, it is taboo, obviously, taboo. But, I mean, essentially, like, because I think gay sex was basically seen as equivalent to something like kink, right?
Yeah, I think that... all of it has been ostracized. Like, all of it has been seen as, like, deviant behavior.
Yeah, deviant. Was that the word deviant you were thinking of? Is what I was looking for, yes.
Yeah, kind of, like, not falling under the conception of like what is considered normal, I guess. And so it all gets kind of like shoved into this one category of like wrongness, I guess, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, basically, it's like it's all abnormal, quote unquote, yeah, under the eyes of the Lord and the law.
Precisely. And Anita Bryant would say so. For sure.
yes.
So, yes, that is one side of it. And then there's another side that is even more, like, practical, which is that a lot of people who engage in kink also tend to be queer. So there's a 2017 study called Bisexuality, Pansexuality, Queer Identity, and Kink Identity, which interviews a number of people who identify under the LGBTQ umbrella, who also identify as being kinky, and found that there were a few like major correlations between the two things. So it found that a lot of these people use kink as a way of playing with gender and sexuality. Can you see how that's the case? Like, you know, this exchange of like gender roles within kink and swapping and
definitely, of course,
it was kind of like a tool for exploration. It also found that people were using it as a tool for healing, kind of a way of like overcoming the experience of being marginalized by virtue of having this like historically stigmatized identity. This is not saying at all that like all LGBTQ people are kinksters, but just that there's like there is like a positive correlation between kink and the community.
Leather daddies.
Well, yes, leather daddies, who we will talk about, and what we will talk about what we owe them.
Yes.
And that is exactly what I'm going to do right this second, actually. so yeah, because of this correlation, kink has been a part of Pride since it began. Hannah, like you said, historically, this group was called leather men or leather daddies. Do you want to tell me what leather daddies are?
It's all in the name, I assume. It's like gay men who like leather.
They like to wear leather. So the leather community is an LGBTQ subculture with its own like code of ethics that hinges greatly upon the transmutation of pain into pleasure and emotional catharsis. It has a self-contained language. It involves sexual practices like, and I will list them off for you, Hannah, so listen up. Fisting, whipping, rope bondage, suspension, piercing, sensory deprivation, temperature play, what have you. Think about club in Berlin. What are people doing? Maybe this.
Yeah. Kit Kat Club.
Kit Kat Club. Leather bars were prominent in American cities even before World War II. When homosexuality was criminalized and taboo, leather became a visual signal or like shorthand for being LGBTQ. There's a leather man literally in the Village People. May he rest in peace, which is one of the most famous like LGBTQ musical acts of the 20th century. There was a really interesting comment on a Reddit thread I was reading about kink that I found a very illuminating. Obviously, this isn't like a peer-reviewed source. It's Reddit, but I did think it was important to read from members of the community itself. So I was trying to get like a big scope of research and opinions, whatever. And this person, whose username is Falcon in the Dive, said, "As we went on into the 80s with the AIDS crisis, cataclysmic death toll in gay men and right-wing backlash, the muscle-bound and therefore healthy, norm-defiant leather man still coasting on the iconography of the previous decade became all the more critical. It's not coincidental that the Folsom Street Fair, which is like, it's like a kink fair that happens in San Francisco. People like literally have sex in public. My friend went and said that he saw a guy like sitting on a fire hydrant, if you get my gist. It's not coincidental that the Folsom Street Fair started in the mid-80s and that in the 90s, TV shows were still using and referencing leather men instead of directly mentioning gay men." So they're kind of, like, leather is a shorthand for being gay for these decades. There's, like, a leather guy on The Simpsons, isn't there?
I don't know. There's, like, the famous episodes that John Waters was on of The Simpsons where Homer thinks that Bart... They meet this, like, really camp guy named John that they become friends with, and, like, Bart really gets along with him, and then Homer gets worried that Bart's gay, and so he keeps trying to, like, make him butch, so he takes him to all these places, like, the firehouse, and all the firemen are gay, and, like, a construction site, and they're all gay, and anyways, that's not the episode of The Simpsons that you're referring to, though.
There was apparently a leather man on The Simpsons, but I haven't watched The Simpsons. I wasn't allowed as a kid, and I still think I'm not allowed now, so I just don't watch it.
That's such a shame. I know everything from The Simpsons. That's how I learned what pop culture was. It taught me
everything.
That's
just not true. It's like Sofia Coppola and all the like soft girl stuff, and you know it.
No, The Simpsons came way first. Way.
Way first.
Way first.
Cool. So from the beginning, Leathermen were instrumental in organizing and contributing to Pride parades, and also at the riots that preceded Pride. In New York, there was a thing called Leather Pride Night, which was the largest financial contributor to Pride, and the leather community generated a large portion of funding and aid during the AIDS epidemic. They were a big contingent in both the 1987 and 1993 marches on Washington as well. I got a lot of this information also from a paper by a queer scholar named Kyle Kingsbury, and in it, they say, what I would like to emphasize here is that leather is more than simply a kink. For many, leather is the language in which they are gay. It supports, structures, and enriches their queer sex, love, and family. The public deployment of leather clothing, gear, and practices can be an expression of personal and cultural identity. Factoring in all of like the pearl clutching that's going on in the discourse, like this whole think of the children thing, do you think it could kind of qualify as a moral panic?
The fear over kink.
Kink at Pride, yeah.
A moral panic, I guess the fear of like what is perceived as deviant, I guess I see it more as like a fear over like the reputation of there is a subsect of gay people that like are fighting really hard to be boring. But I just think like, right, if you have your like marriage equality, let's wear J. Crew sweaters and, you know, live in the suburbs, people fighting for that, then I think that having a bunch of like like old guys in leather vests and chokers maybe like doesn't help sell your narrative that you should be like welcomed into these communities that like have historically excluded you. Like, I get why those people wouldn't want that to be something that was like inherently associated with like homosexuality. However, I'm not the person to be like saying whether or not like it's valid, but I think that it's a bit ignorant of the history that you just laid out.
Yeah, I would agree that I don't think it's like a moral panic, because it's not a fear of something new happening or something new overtaking or like invading some sort of safe culture. But yeah, more of like almost like a tired, like we're tired, you know, that.
Yeah.
It's like a, oh no, they're at it again, you know, kind of thing.
I totally, yeah.
But I really loathe any time anyone really like is like thinking of the children, because it's almost always not actually in service of children.
No, the children are like always the calling card that gets some sort of more liberal, like social, political cause to be somehow married with like conservative values. Like it's how the feminists ended up in bed with the like right wing and the Christian forces, and it's probably how you have all these like weird gay men who are in the Trump administration, you know?
Gay men, weird gay men. And Hannah just sent me a reel that was like, finally to go on my first gay conservative cruise.
It's the first ever gay conservative cruise.
And the top comment was like, final destination, Tel Aviv.
Yeah, think of the children as just like a really... Because everyone likes kids for the most part, and everyone wants the best for them.
Well, so, a lot of people hate kids, and a lot of people don't want the best for them.
That's true.
Not me, I like kids, but...
Normal, like, nice American civilians. Like, you know, it's like a really easy way to, like...
There are people who think kids, like, shouldn't be allowed in public.
Right, but I'm talking more about the idea, if someone is, like, in the culture posing, like, a certain behavior as somehow... to the detriment of children, even though, like, why are leather daddies to the detriment of children? Children don't understand what that shit is. But if you're doing that and, like, you're someone who is not engaged with that and also who, like, wants to seem or feel or be, like, a nice, upstanding citizen who cares about children, because most of us do, then it's a really easy way to, like, get you accidentally working in cahoots with people who actually don't have the best interests of yourself or children at heart.
Yeah, I think the way that it can kind of inch towards being a moral panic is that it's inching towards this sect of our society who think that exposure to, like, drag queens will, like, make their kids gay, or exposure to, like, yeah, like, weirdness will make their kids weird. And I think that that's... That could very easily, it's like it's making bedfellows with that type of person.
I also, though, feel like a lot of the people who are like, kink is pride bad for children, are the people who grew up on RuPaul's Drag Race and like grew up on Queer Eye and grew up on like TV friendly gay.
Well, the thing is, yeah, a lot of them are like Gen Z iPad kid queer kids. Like, it's like a lot of them aren't queer kids themselves, just iPad addicted, and so it's like, or like terminally online, and so yeah, they've definitely consumed a media diet of like weirdness.
Yeah
So I asked Russell about this because like it is kind of hard to reconcile, like, whenever children are brought into the conversation. The reason I don't like it is because it's a very flattening argument. It's like something that people reach hands across the aisle and shake on, so it makes defending kink at Pride really difficult. So I asked Russell about this, and they had some like practical suggestions, which we actually see kind of brought up in those more incendiary tweets at the top when we started. I think once you throw the words like consent into the mix, and once you throw the word children into the mix, it gets very difficult to kind of parse through the conversation. But a lot of times people are like, I didn't consent to seeing something sexual like that, or children can't consent, and like children should be able to come to Pride because they're young. And I don't know, how have you, I mean, you don't have to have a definitive answer, but like, I've been having trouble reconciling that in even just like writing this episode. And I'm curious to know what you think of that.
I mean, that is a challenge. I understand all of those concerns. I have an 8-year-old and they come to Pride, but honestly, like, just from a personal, like, anecdotal perspective, when I take my, at San Diego Pride specifically, I'll speak to the experience of that. The kink section of Pride is sort of cordoned off in its own way. You need to, like, show ID to get in. You have to be 18 or older. It's, like, very clear that you're, like, consenting to go into this area, whereas, like, no one's carding the kids going into the kids area. It is, clearly there are different spaces for people looking for different experiences in the way that the layout is designed. That isn't necessarily the case, obviously, for, like, the parade component, where folks are also in fetish gear. But I think that a big part of it for me is, like, being open to having conversations about what the space is, or, like, why people are dressed a certain way, how people are experiencing their own bodies and their own pleasures and the situation of the space, why it is important socially that we are here doing this together. Again, ultimately, I think realizing that, like, the space of Pride is different for everyone who's experiencing it, and that some spaces can be for you, like in the same Pride celebration, some spaces can be for you and some spaces cannot be for you. And that is great. At least in my mind, that's a part of it, is like seeing how and where you fit in, what resonates with you, what doesn't. And moving through it with that sort of intention from the start. The experience is so different when you go with kids and when you don't. And they're both beautiful. And I don't think one should foreclose or eclipse the other.
When I was a baby, the first people I met was a drag queen named Burger.
Burger!
And that's why I'm such a deviant.
And they were actually dressed up as Burger from Sex and the City. And they were actually wearing a post-it note that said,
that's the worst drag costume I've ever heard of. One of Carrie Bradshaw's boyfriends.
But like, yeah, when you think about the children thing, I think the best way to kind of shut that down is, like, you really can't help but see the disparity when heterosexual people are being sexual in public. Like, Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, or Beyonce, or like every major pop star basically, or like Calvin Klein ads. Like, yes, those things do get criticism, those people get criticism, but it's so much more ubiquitous, like, overt sexuality within like the heterosexual sphere, and it's seen as something that can be profited off of more, so children are invoked a lot less when it comes to that.
Lady Gaga is, like, you know, at like certain points of her career was dressed essentially as a leather daddy, but like her songs being played at Target.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm working on a video right now about gentrification. Actually, it already came out at the time of recording this. I just posted it 2 hours ago. And in it, I talk about how the word gentrification has become diluted in recent years, more to describe like the way that it's kind of used to talk about cultural appropriation. But if I were to use it to describe the no kink at Pride discourse, Hannah, how do you think it would fit in here? Like, even in a literal housing sense, like, how do you think gentrification has overlap with the no kink at Pride discourse?
Because you have rich Erewhon gays coming in and kicking out, like, you know.
The literal smoothie is kicking people out.
Yes. No, well, yeah, I just think it's like I was saying, I'm sorry I keep calling gay guys boring, but I mean, like, as queer culture becomes less of like a subcultural thing and like people are able to be part of like mainstream life and then just also like happen to be like gay. You just have like normies, right? Who are proud and who are wanting to like participate in like certain aspects of gay culture, but also who like aren't necessarily at all related to any of the kind of,
are they boots on the ground? Are they boots?
Are they boots? Are they leather boots on the ground?
Are they leather boots on the ground?
Are we gonna get canceled? No, yeah, people probably don't do that anymore. No, I just am like, in the gentrification sense, it's like you have people of a higher tax bracket who are gay and who like don't have that attachment to like, yeah, those original struggles, and who like aren't part of this more transgressive or like countercultural. And I keep singling out gay men. I don't know why. I'm talking about everyone.
Sometimes you feel very defensive of them because they're holding down the freak, which we discovered in our last episode.
Yeah, no, and there are some like lesbian yuppies.
Corporate lesbians who wear Fitbits. That's like a genre of woman.
Yeah, to cite Sex and the City again, power lesbians and Prada loafers.
But these ones aren't buying art either. They're like corporate lesbians who wear like long low ponytails and wear Fitbits. Like tech lesbians. Like there's a tech lesbian out there and she's like taking peptides. Anyways, so so there's this book called Gentrification of the Mind by Sarah Schulman, which I absolutely love. It's about the ways that gentrification and AIDS impact one another. Basically, in gayborhoods in New York, like Greenwich and Chelsea and the East Village and West Village, huge swaths of gay men died in their apartments, and their apartments vacated and then skyrocketed to market prices. And she says that it had both a psychic shift in the way that the new LGBTQ people moving into the city who could afford these new prices did not have the same context, like you're saying, Hannah, of trauma and survival that the previous generation did, and instead assimilated more to like general society. And then also she says that there was a literal shift in housing because the new populations of the gayborhoods were like straight WASPs from the suburbs. And she has this quote where she says, gay life is now expected to take place in private in the West Village by people who are white, upper class, and sexually discreet. And for context, Stonewall is in the West Village. It's in Greenwich. So I do think the idea of gentrification very much applies to the kink at pride debate, if we're taking into consideration both like the young demographics who have less context or access to this painful history, to a time where queer people were being brutalized and criminalized, and then also the people living in the areas where prides take place, right? Who are more likely to be NIMBY about it. Like, get this gay man with his assless chaps out of my backyard.
Yeah.
You know?
To cite Sex and the City again, Samantha hate criming those trans sex workers when she moves into the meatpacking district.
Everyone was really mad at me that I called it a hate crime, which I know it's not a hate crime. It's a...
Sorry, it was a crime against a marginalized population.
It's an assault, for sure.
An assault.
So, and you mentioned this earlier, but there's also another factor of gentrification, too. Do you want to guess what that is?
Erewhon?
Oh my god, she's addicted to Erewhon. She gets to talking about Erewhon. She's obsessed.
Erewhon is like the craziest phenomenon to me. Oh, corporations? Corporations, like Erewhon.
Good job, Hannah. Yes. So corporations like Erewhon. Are you just thinking
about
Erewhon?
The Sabrina Carpenter smoothie.
So, yeah, as it becomes normalized to be queer, corporations wanted to profit off the popularity of that. And so, like, you know, your local freaking TD Bank would have a float in the march.
Can I just say, the first drag performance I ever saw was from... was at Pride when I was 11, and it was a TD-sponsored drag queen.
Was she dressed in all green?
Yes.
I'm not kidding. I'm about to go take my rent out at a TD, like, right after we talk. Because speaking of gentrification, my landlord's a little angel, and he doesn't, you know, he's got that rent-stabilized rent. But the exchange for that is that I have to pay him in cash, which is really inconvenient.
That is inconvenient.
So Pride has become super corporate and therefore corporate friendly. It doesn't bode well for these companies, which still have like mass market appeal, to have their logos photographed next to someone's pierced ball sack. What does bode well for corporations is a little thing called respectability politics.
Ah.
Hannah, what is it?
The idea that like a marginalized group, I guess it's like this sort of like internalized belief. It's like in order to... further their cause or to like, you know, get out of this sort of marginalized space is to like present yourself as respectable and like assimilate into like mainstream culture and like mainstream societal norms.
Yeah.
It's political action through being boring.
Like using the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. It's using the master's tools to like build another smaller house that's attached to the master's house.
But that's a drive away from an Erewhon. It's using the master's tools to make a Hailey Bieber smoothie.
Oh, very good.
It feels so much to me like we have gravitated from like a lavender panic of the 1950s to, I don't know what, a pastel panic now. Like it's, there's such a similarity, I think, in the way that, there's such a cyclicality in the way that we understand who the threats to our social infrastructure are. And queer folks, unfortunately, seem to be continually in that spiral.
So I guess, like, how do you think the idea of respectability politics plays into that?
I mean, what a moment to be talking about respectability politics also as well. Like, this feels like the Gavin Newsom problem to me at the moment, where it's like we're being told so much, like, we got to talk less about pronouns. We got to talk less about trans people. We got to talk less about any group that diverges from appearing as normal, like, quote unquote, normal as humanly possible. And I think that hasn't done us well in the past. I don't think it's going to do us any favors now. Ultimately, I think respectability politics encourages any sort of minority group, but certainly queer folks, to take on behaviors or live in a way, present themselves in a way that is as close to a normative lifestyle as possible. And to my mind, at least, I'm sure lots of people will disagree with me, but that isn't the point of what pride is, and that isn't necessarily the point of what queerness is.
There is a bit of a boomerang, kind of like horseshoe effect with these tweets from young people in the way of actually being super homophobic. Like, I don't know if you got that sense, especially when it's like the picture of the gay man with a spiky outfit on. It's like, you just want to be treated normal and this is how you're dressing, as if that's like harming gay rights.
You're like, why do gay men want to be naked around children? It's like, no, gay men want to be naked and you're forcing your children to go to like this event.
Well, and also, yeah, there's like these historical implications of like, oh, gay men being pedophiles, right? And that is such an...
so harmful.
There's such an intense subtext of that in that tweet. Like, it's doing the same ostracization that homophobic society has done for all of history.
Yeah, it's Anita Bryant boots.
Yeah, and I feel like it's a similar case with Gen Z and, like, Gen Alpha being kind of, like, anti-sex. And it ending up being kind of misogynistic as a result of that. And while it's great and necessary that many queer people want to have the same civic rights as straight people, like, totally, this can sometimes bleed into, like, adapting to the heteronormative society, like we're saying, the master's tools that oppress queer people rather than trying to fundamentally change those structures of oppression. It does feel like a bit of a psyop sometimes, like the presence of corporations and cops, like, walking at Pride while on the surface looking like solidarity almost feels kind of like a clandestine, like, boot on the neck a little bit. Like, you know, we're going to keep you in order. This person says, and this person's on Reddit, and I don't remember their name, but they had this comment that I really liked. I'll try and link these Reddit threads in the description if I remember. They say, when it was all about survival, the distinction that straight people drew between gay, kinky, polyamorous, trans, ace, etc. was irrelevant. They'd kill us all, so we might as well band together and make a world in which the next generation might not just live, but thrive. But once it became about gaining access to state acceptance and making room within the legal framework that already existed, those of us who were too scary to straight society, who still needed the hierarchy destroyed, not just expanded, became dead weight. I thought that was really well phrased.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of a way of like putting forward the least threatening faces of this community as like the poster children for it. Like, even in the years, and if we're going to be like talking about Marsha P. Johnson all the time these days, like in the years following Stonewall, there was a large consideration as to whether or not Marsha P. Johnson should be credited so publicly because she was a sex worker and trans, right? So, like, yeah, it's funny when these people in the same tweet when they're being, like, anti-kink of pride will also invoke Marsha P. Johnson. And it's, like, there are some pretty intense ideological contradictions there.
Absolutely. And they did her dirty.
I mean, they did her very dirty. Also, she was very likely murdered by either the mafia or like in a gay bashing, and her story is extremely devastating.
It's so devastating.
An interesting text I would also like to point people to if you want to think more about like the concept of assimilation is Lee Edelman's No Future. It's been like kind of controversial since it came out. It's a book, but it basically talks about how gay people have been considered a threat to dominant society because they have sex that doesn't result in reproduction, you know, the production of children. Children who will one day enter the workforce and contribute to society. And so it's like interrogating like the very concept of homophobia. So Edelman takes the radical stance that maybe gay people should just stop trying to even like have kids, stop getting married, and in doing so, like protest the oppressive structure of the nuclear family unit. And I think that's interesting when we factor like children into this discourse too. Although I know a lot of it's about like queer kids and not just like kids in general. But I just think that's something to chew on. I've always found that text really eye-opening, I guess. Although someone will probably disagree with me. It really is this concept that you can, like, have your rights only on the condition that you'll behave, which still gives all the power to the power holders.
Well, it's the same with so many, like, marginalized groups and, like, communities.
Which is why we arrive at the question, what is pride for? What is it for, Hannah?
Well, it's like commemorating a massive act of protest, and that doesn't necessarily mean that like it needs to have a consistently like exclusively radical or like tone to it per se. Like it can be like a celebration, but celebration also doesn't mean that it needs to be sort of like it doesn't need to be sanitized. Right. And like today, it kind of almost feels like, you know, when you have like parent teacher night and it's like showing all the work that you've done on the walls, it feels like it's like gay parent teacher night for straight people.
Damn, Hannah, good metaphor.
But it's just like, look, guys, it's fun here. We got drag queens reading like picture books and you can get like a rainbow branded IKEA bag like Chapel Roan. Like, I don't know.
It's like face painting. Like, yeah, Chapel Roan will paint your face. Like,
it's yeah. Or we'll paint Chapel Roan on your face, whichever you like.
It's a family friendly event of the ages. Yeah. Like, come one, come all. It's very come one, come all, which yes, but also like yes, but no, but also yes, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, people on Twitter love to be like, pride is for everyone. Pride is a family event. But actually, it's considered a polyvocal event. So, like, I'm hearing what you're saying, Hannah. You mentioned like, protest, you mentioned commemoration, you mentioned celebration. And like even the event itself, like it's a march, it's a parade, it's a festival, it's all sorts of groups. There's different offshoot parades, there's like various agendas from all ends, there's different nights, there's different types of walks. And on top of being celebration, commemoration, show of community, political protest, it's also like sometimes a cruising site. Very importantly, though, to me, like from my research, because it's all about me. Very importantly, though, like from my research, what I got is that it's a cultural protest. Like extremely integral to pride is the idea of visibility. There's a reason they call it like a closet, right? You are not visible. You are now visible. Queerness has historically been shoved into the private sphere. Queer people had to meet in clandestine spaces, often putting themselves in danger to do so. If you were trans, you weren't able to embody that identity in public. There's a gay leather man who was quoted in 1991 as saying, "In a world that functions on sexual repression, the sight of two queens or dykes walking down the street is a vision of the gradual cracking of the social order." Like the very just concept of like a queer person existing in public was so fraught for so long. Another thing is that the state, like the law, would not only push queerness into the private sphere, it would also impose itself into queer bedrooms with laws prohibiting LGBTQ sex. If this act, like that happens in private, warrants arrest and like had warranted arrest historically, then the point with pride is to bring the private onto the street. Like that was a major element of it. That's a major element of like the kink and the sexual charge of the event. The idea that like the state made it public already, right? By criminalizing it for so long. Mm-hmm. So when people at Pride are engaging in acts that are usually relegated to the bedroom, it's kind of like a fuck you to the systems of oppression that impose themselves. Again, like, and I was actually waiting for you to say this. I'm shocked you haven't yet, but the personal is political. You actually said it in our last episode.
No, I tried to say it as like a really stupid joke.
When you said it, I was like, oh, save that for the next one. And then you haven't even said it.
I'm sorry, I forgot. Yes, well, the personal is political. Well, yes.
the presence of kink at Pride is like a radical act of self-expression. It's like, it's expressly anti-assimilationist. Russell touched on this too.
Pride started as a form of very visible protest, and at a moment where there were disagreements about respectability as well, but where we're being radical in visibility when we get together in public space and we take public space. And I do think that there is something about those first Pride marches where ownership over space became a really important part of it. And in some situations, like, permits were granted, and in other situations, they weren't. And there is something important about, like, taking space to, again, be visible. I think it all comes back to visibility.
In what ways are the, I guess, aesthetics of pleasure, like the aesthetics of sex, used by the LGBTQ community? And can these aesthetics be separated from this ongoing battle for progress, or separated from Pride?
Can I read you a section of a book? I brought some, like, some queer theory along with
me. I love that. Please.
This is my scholar brain here. I think that this speaks to this. So in this article that Michael Warner and Lauren Berlant wrote called Sex in Public, they write, heterosexual culture achieves much of its metacultural intelligibility through the ideologies and institutions of intimacy. Intimacy is itself publicly mediated in several senses. First, its conventional spaces presuppose a structural differentiation of personal life, quote-unquote personal life, from work, politics, and the public sphere. Second, the normativity of heterosexual culture links intimacy only to the institutions of personal life, making them privileged institutions of social reproduction, the accumulation and transfer of capital, and self-development. Third, by making sex seem irrelevant or merely personal, heteronormative conventions of intimacy block the building of non-normative or explicit public sexual cultures. Finally, those conventions conjure a mirage, a home base of pre-political humanity from which citizens are thought to come into political discourse and to which they are expected to return in the always imaginary future after political conflict. I think that, like, so much of like the discourse that you're describing comes back to that, to understanding the desire for us as human people, certainly as queer people, but I think just in general, to understand sex and sexuality as something that exists in our homes, in our apartments, in our private space, although governments barge in and disrupt that all the time anyway. So I think a big part of what certainly queer theory, but I think queer movements in general, encourage us to do is to understand that sex and sexuality, the pleasures that we find or that we desire, as something that should be or that fundamentally is public, that the restraining of those to the private space is a way of mediating who can experience those pleasures, when they can experience those pleasures, and ultimately how to make them a part of a larger capitalist system. There's such a desire, I think, for some folks that I honestly find baffling that, like, Pride should be a big gay picnic. And it isn't. Like, that's not the history of what it is. And also, like, I love a picnic, would love to go and be around a whole bunch of other queers, you know, enjoying a space in that way. But Pride specifically, I think, is an opportunity to experience your own desires in the space of the desires of others who are being brave in that radical visibility. When I go to Pride, or I march in Pride, or I wander around the Pride booths at San Diego Pride, there's lots of stuff where I'm like, that's really cool. I get to learn about how other people are experiencing the world. And they're being brave in being there and taking that space. And I want to be able to have an exchange with them. I want to learn about how other people are experiencing their queerness. And I hope that I can bring that as well.
Kingsbury calls the people at Pride a counterpublic, where participants have a chance to temporarily create the culture that they wish could exist and show it to the world. But of course, as Pride got less radical following AIDS and people lost sight of that context and corporations are involved, it became something else entirely, like less a protest and more, as Russell put it, a big gay party. So kink, like, having been there all along at this stage of LGBTQ rights, becomes abstracted by people who don't understand its value in relation to the community, and it becomes, you know, shoved away or dead weight, quote unquote.
And I think there's so much of that too, that's like, I'm a white person who can pass in the world. I, like, exist in and out of what appear to be heteronormative circles all the time. And my privilege at Pride is to be there and to experience things with people and to try to help create or contribute towards space that allows others who don't have that safety outside of that zone to do that as well. So I think when we get to a point where we start to try to regulate the way that other people are bringing themselves to a protest that's fundamentally about being radically visible, I get uncomfortable.
And can you see why turning kinksters into dead weight, like this attitude of like, we have our rights now, so why do you have to shove it all in our faces, is actually really bad for this explicit current moment?
Well, yeah, because even the more sanitized aspects of gay culture are being demonized heavily right now in the States. I feel like just after like there had reached this moment of the drag queen sort of becoming completely detached from like her origins and becoming more of like this like really palatable, like marketable face of gay culture, just as that was happening, now there's been like this huge like demonization of drag. Like that's a huge moral panic, like we mentioned earlier, in a way like that has made its way into the law books. And so if something on like the much more like, obviously not all of drag is family friendly at all, but like something that is more family friendly than kink, like if that's being demonized, then what would happen to someone who is like actually partaking in like a transgressive or like taboo, activity doesn't feel like the right word, culture act. And like lifestyle, I guess, act. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think the respectability politics of it all like clearly didn't work, because like you're either going to be like Caitlyn Jenner, who is such a confusing figure because she's like still like, she's not like detransitioned, but she's anti-trans,
yeah,
Republican woman. Yeah. Or you're going to be like kind of thrown out with everyone else. Like there's no, like you don't put everyone down to like level up, because like you're, everyone's the same to them, to the powers that be at the end of the day.
Well, like, yeah, like that person was saying, like when it's about survival, it's not about like who's who, what's what, like everyone is going to be demonized. And like, yes, drag queens are being demonized right now. Trans people are being like actively persecuted and like scapegoated around the world, but like recently very much across the States.
And the UK, like, oh my God. Yeah,
exactly. And so it does go to show that like Pride, once again, needs to be an act of protest. It shows like the necessity for that. The purpose is not to find like a family-friendly, defanged poster child for the LGBTQ community. It's to make like the most invisible members of these groups, like Marsha P. Johnson once was, visible. And Marsha P. Johnson is often invoked by the same people saying that Pride shouldn't be sexualized, right? It's like, she's a literal sex worker. You can't commemorate if you're betraying the core tenets of what you're commemorating. So like, yes, I do think, like Russell was saying, you can have like different events for different things. And you could take your kids to certain more friendly events. There can be like options there, but I do think just like ideologically, the general spirit of the debate feels quite harmful and quite antithetical. And I just don't think it can be a matter of like, we've moved past this because, quote, like we have rights now, because if the last couple of years have shown us anything, it's like how quickly those rights can go away.
Personally, my solution is teach your kid to hang.
Can your kid hang? And here's Russell to close us off. Like, do you think that the culture has ever gotten close to what Warner and like Edelman were talking about? Do you think that we lost it somewhere along the way, or do you think like we've just never gotten there and we've just been on this path towards, I guess, like more Puritan culture? I don't know. I feel like we were doing a backslide for some reason.
I feel like in my archival brain, we seem to be on like a 100-year clock. Like we go through these cycles every 100 years. And so like so much of that 1920s logic around like sort of Puritan vice reform, the necessity of regulating the bodies of others, the pleasures of others, the experiences that others are allowed to have, where those experiences are allowed to occur, how class is implicated in those pleasures. I think that all feels very, very current. And so I think to your question about like, have we ever hit a point where like the Edelman or Warner framework is like, we're close, we're right there. I don't know. I think it's changed a lot of the discourse. I don't know that it's any less radical than it was at the height of the AIDS crisis. In my queer cinema class, we watched the Greg Araki film, The Living End. It's like, you know, early 1990s, two young men who are recently diagnosed with HIV, who are in this sort of existential crisis. They go on a sort of violence-fueled road trip together. There's murder, there's rape, there's all sorts of nasty things. And the film, I think, is really interesting because it's very accessible. Like, it's a pleasurable watch. But it is also one of those texts where folks respond very differently, in my experience, at least in a classroom with undergraduates, where there are folks who are like, this is really bad representation. Like, this is harmful to see folks behaving so badly, queer folks behaving so badly. And then there are an equal amount of voices in the room that have the opposite response, which is like, no, when you're in the midst of a crisis, you need to have complex representation. You need to be able to be feeling through all of your desires and your emotions, and you need to have a vent for that. It can't just be the one version that's palatable to someone else. And I think that feels very present now also. Like,
yeah,
that hasn't changed since 1992. I understand that, like, we get scared of people who have desires that don't look like ours. But ultimately, how did you land there? And who's profiting off of your fear? And I think that becomes a really fundamental part of the conversation. Is that somewhere in the chain, somebody is making money off the fact that our fear can be mobilized.
My bank is making so much money off of that. Yeah, their rainbow app every June.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if respectability politics is the way to get towards capital, not the way to get towards revolution, not the way to get towards larger acceptance of ourselves and our community and our bodies and each other, then we got to stop that. We got to be the nasty versions of ourselves that we are. Thank you.